You're listening to the Ask Drone You podcast. You ask, we answer your drone questions. Whether you're here to turn your passion into profit or you simply fly for fun, we're a community of learners and teachers who aspire to achieve greatness. We are
Drone You.
Hey everyone, and welcome to another fantastic episode of Ask Drone You. My name is Paul, and I have a very special guest here today to help us understand a very substantial problem in the drone industry in regards to public safety. There's so much information all on the internet, and as public safety groups try to gain market share through the industry, the amount of poor information being really distributed through the internet is oftentimes, well, going to set someone else up to fail. And because we care about the people who are willing to risk their lives to save us, it's important that we get the right information out there. That's why today we're going to be talking about how public safety should be operating drones. More so, we're going to be talking about the decisions that you should be making as a public safety agency to really decide on how to operate. There are different types of agencies all over the country, from federal agencies to large city agencies and departments to local municipalities and volunteer groups. How do COAs allow those departments to fly? And how is it different from Part 107? Should every department just be flying under Part 107? Well, that's why we're here today and what we're going to be talking about. And joining me today is a 15-year veteran of FDNY, the firefighters from New York City. And I'm talking about John Wakey, who's been in the robotics department long enough to know a lot more than me when it comes to robotics. John, welcome to the show. Great to have you.
Nice having you, Paul. Thank you for having me.
John, you've been on the show before, and we've been talking about the drones that really work really well for departments, and that particular show has, well, done very, very well. So first of all, thank you, and a large thank you from the community to you for being willing to really help out guys like yourself.
Oh, but it's a pleasure. I look forward to that. The more information, especially the more good information we get out there, the better we're able to prepare these smaller agencies and larger agencies to at least start off on the right path and make these decisions correctly the first time. It really eases the learning curve on some of this stuff that is just jumbled all throughout the internet. Different people with different views and not always the right ones. Hopefully we can clear a lot of that up.
Yeah, and hopefully we can provide really more of a kind of comprehensive view, right? Providing information on both sides so that people can make their own decision, because at the end of the day, everyone has different variables, different environments, and different scenarios. As you know, you're in the concrete jungle, and I don't have anything over 18 stories within 1,000 miles, so.
Yeah, it's definitely a concrete jungle. We have all kinds of interference from GPS multipathing to, you know, magnetic interference, Wi-Fi saturation. We have our work cut out for us. You know, three major airports, a lot of small heliports and minor airports, a couple of seaplane bases, National Park Services, you know.
I really think that you're such the perfect example of a person to come on the show and talk about this, because you're flying in the most difficult airspace in the entire United States, hands down, no questions asked. So I think you're coming from such a great practical standpoint, and you know how I am about that. So again, thank you. But let's get right into it. All right. Public safety agencies, firefighters, law enforcement, obviously they use drones for different things, from, you know, firefighters and utilizing it for, you know, hotspot recognition, wildland fires, hazmat, confined area rescue, high angle rescue, crowd control, versus LEOs who may be really working more with barricaded suspects, again, confined space searching, but also maybe some persistent surveillance and a few different applications for drones. Now, that being said, with these different applications, we have really two navigational paths that we can take as a department or public safety agency when we want to fly drones. Now, we can get a COA, also known as a POW COA, and we can also get or fly under Part 107. Now, I think it's easy for most people to understand that under the COA, there is a little bit more freedom per se, but there's a lot more upfront work in really acquiring the right information, building the right resources, task lists, currency and proficiency lists, standard operating procedures, and deployment protocols. There's so much that goes into that, even self-certifying pilots. So you're really asking anyone in the department like yourself to say, hey, the FAA came up with a great way to regulate 107, and they're saying we're leaving it up to us on how we want to regulate ourselves, which is quite the interesting way to lead people. But then there's the second navigational path, which is Part 107, which most people are familiar with. Part 107 is really comes down to the pilot, which is great because you can do so much. You can do training exercises. You can do so much. So let's get into the meat and potatoes. COA versus 107 at a macro level, what do people need to know about considering one path versus the other?
Well, a COA is great if you're in a large city. I mean, where you have complex airspaces and stuff like that. A 107 is great for everything else. A 107 will work in a large city. It's just normally you want to go the route of the COA if you're a large department. New York, Chicago, Miami, big city, big problems. Other than that, the 107, hands down, is the way to go. The COA takes additional resources to do. Like you said up front, you have to file for all this paperwork. You have to have your operating procedures, a declaration letter. So there's a lot more moving parts to file for the COA versus just going, getting a 107 as a pilot and going that whole route. However, the COA allows you to self-certify, like you mentioned before, which I don't agree with. I think everybody should take their, you know, get the learner's permit first, which would be the 107, before they start operating the aircraft in some of the most complex environments that we know.
And so that's a good point that you bring up, is that under a COA, the program manager is going to have to create a system that will be approved to train and self-certify drone pilots. So it sounds like if you have a drone program manager who's not innately familiar with aviation, airspace, and specifically operating drones, you could be setting up the department for quite a substantial amount of liability.
Correct. And that liability, like you said many times before, insurance companies run the world, right? And how do you say that this pilot was following the correct order when that order is not recognized through the FAA? That was an order that was created by large city drone program. You know, at least the 107 is a standard where you could say, well, no, the pilot checked the airspace, the pilot made the notifications, the pilot did this, the pilot did that, and he did it according to this law that was written that says that was crossed off that list. If you self-certify, you can actually open the department up for liabilities in the event of an accident or, you know, some sort of damage. If it lands on a car or something along those lines, they could say that you weren't operating within proper guidelines.
Yeah, and which brings up a plethora of other issues to kind of go down. But one of those issues that I see, at least from the operator standpoint, from the individual standpoint, if I have to learn department COA from one department, and let's say my wife got a new job in Chicago and I need to move to Chicago, it seems like I might have to relearn everything because the COAs could be completely different versus if I had a Part 107, then the systems and standards that I'm used to, say, in New York are going to be standardized throughout the country.
Correct. Everything would change from COA to COA because every one of them, you know, it's a guidelines based on that department's needs. However, the 107 fits everywhere, like we've mentioned. Our pilots are all 107 trained. We feel that that is the bare minimum that a pilot should be trained, would be obtaining that Part 107. That gives you the information that you need to know, complex airspace and how to read sectional charts, and a lot of the information that they also need to know, like, you know, KP index and magnetic interference and Wi-Fi saturation. That comes later. But at least they understand the rules of the sky. That's the bare minimum. Pilots have the 107, and they also file for a nighttime waiver. The majority of our pilots have their own nighttime waiver. That allows us, because as you know, you cannot train under a COA.
I was just going to bring that up. Yeah.
And you can't go fly. So now, if I wanted to teach somebody night operations, I need that nighttime waiver. And when we do our training flights, the majority of them are under Part 107. We do have like large scale training exercises that we do. And then we could, because it's so many moving parts, we could actually file that under the COA, because it's not just like, oh, we're going to take Bill to the park to go fly. We're operating with, you know, a rescue, a special operations command, Marine units. There's EMS assets. There's PD involved in some cases, like when we do these large scale mock-up exercises, and that they're basically like full scale emergencies without the real actual emergency. So we could justify that as, you know, an emergency operation because of the amount of people and resources that are going to it.
But that brings up a really good point, because if you're flying particularly under a COA and you can't do training flights, then how the hell are these guys going to earn the practical experience to be able to utilize a tool and save someone's life with it without actually further endangering said situation, right? That, and then that brings up another great point too, as far as operating under a COA. Now your department aviation insurance versus saying insuring the individual pilot or the group as a whole under Part 107. And that brings up a whole nother issue in itself, because most insurance, and I don't think a lot of public safety agencies are aware of this, every single department insurance in line item says you must be following FAA guidelines. So, and I know that this has already happened, there is one particular public safety agency in an insurance battle right now because their insurance says follow FAA guidelines, but because they're operating under a COA, they're really operating under their own guidelines, which are now being kind of audited as far as their culpability for truly providing safe flights.
Correct. And what a COA is taking the power away from the FAA and putting it under that entity. That's giving that entity the sole responsibility of that pilot's flights. That should not be. The FAA, they have a standard in place, which was the Part 107. They have the waiver process. And if you need to do something absolutely crazy that you it doesn't possibly fall under anything, there's the SGI portal. And the SGI portal will allow you to fly up to 1,100 feet or go into this airspace and operate because there's an emergency there and it needs to be done. That will get you, you know, access to, you know, TFRs. If something were to happen and you need to operate within the TFR, you could go through the SGI portal. And that is, you don't need a COA for that. You could do that under Part 107 if you're operating for an emergency response. So everything that the COA really does for you, you could do with a Part 107. It just might take a little bit longer. So the value of the COA comes from just having, like I said, a large department where they have the resources and complex airspace. It will allow you not to make these requests over and over. But how do you file for a COA if you're a volunteer fire department in the Midwest somewhere? And let's say you have a river, which is very prone to flooding. Every spring, this river floods, and a drone would be a perfect tool. But you wouldn't be able to file for a COA because you can't get a declaration letter because you're a volunteer organization. So now you are forced to fly under Part 107, which should be this. It should be the bare minimum that a department, it's the easiest route to go on. So there, a COA isn't going to work in every application. Just the large scale applications.
Yeah, and you brought up a point about 5 minutes ago about the fact that Part 107 teaches you the basics, but understanding flying in magnetic environments and the environment as a whole is totally different. And I just want to touch on that for a second because I think it's so important that people understand Part 107 is just to pass a government test and have a basis of foundation of information to understand how to fly. It doesn't teach you how to operate, and it doesn't teach you how to really understand the environment and operating as a whole. Now, that being said, moving on into the SGI, I forget what SGI stands for. I want to say it's like special government
interest.
So for those of you who don't understand what SGI is, essentially, if there's an emergency situation and you didn't need almost an emergency COA to fly within a TFR or outside of the purview of 107, just as John mentioned, the eCOA or SGI is the back door to the FAA to get a handshake to go do whatever you need almost immediately.
Yeah, we've put in SGI requests before, and I will say that from the start of the SGI process to us being in the air was well under 10 minutes. In most cases, it was almost instant.
Wow.
Yeah. So, we're a large department, so you can't go off of that. But that is manned 24/7 by the FAA. They have always somebody there to check the email, and you call up afterwards, and you get answers immediately. I mean, obviously, if you're asking for something completely bizarre, you know, you could get denied. But most of the time, when it's an actual need or an emergency, and it's within the realm of possibility, I mean, within, I want to say, the safe possibility, where it's a practical application, it's safe, but you just need to extend your capabilities a little bit more, the SGI is a perfect way to do that. They really, hands down, made it very easy and very, you know, quick turnaround time on the FAA's part on that, which is what we look for. Time is of the essence.
And just to be clear, you can operate under this SGI protocol under Part 107 or correct. Under a COA. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes. The SGI, if you're an emergency organization or a public safety entity, you can get an SGI request for as long as you are who you are. You're not going to get one because you want to do a nighttime flight over a house for real estate photography. That's not an SGI request.
Yeah.
But if you had to fly at night with no night waiver for, you know, a structural fire or, you know, barricaded suspect or search and rescue mission, you will be able to do that under an SGI request with the 107 if you're connected to a public safety entity.
And I think that's great. And I think what we should do is really break down the different types of departments really quick and look at COA versus 107, because there are some other caveats to this COA that I don't think a lot of departments are familiar with, which is under 107, the FAA under AC 107-2 specifically states that you do not need to have any requirements at all for reporting or what is it called? I forget the specific language that's utilized, but it's reporting and or documenting your flights. Obviously, if you want to be a successful pilot, having a flight log is very important. And if you're running a drone program, it's quintessential, but it's also quintessential for fleet management and personnel management. But I think the key point, again, 107 versus COA, 107, there is no requirement or standardization of documenting the program or flights. Under a COA, there is a monthly reporting requirement. And what does that look like? And is that kind of taxing for smaller agencies? Because when we look at the large city agency, let's say a regular city, anything sub the big five cities, right? And then we have a rural department and a volunteer department. We'll take these different subjects and apply them to each. But as far as reporting, monthly reporting, what does that look like? And practically speaking, what effect does that have on the department?
Well, as far as the size of the monthly reporting, I don't actually physically do it. Somebody else does that, and that's the benefit of being in a big department. We're able to spend the resources to allow somebody to oversee that part of it. So I focus on making sure that we operate in the safe, effective manner that we operate, and they take care of the paperwork aspect of it so that that reporting is done correctly. But I would assume, because we've been asked on several occasions, oh, we need to update this, this needs to be updated, this needs to be updated so I can get the monthly out. So there is some running around, we have 8 or 9 pilots that are currently active into, you know, putting stuff in there. I mean, we have 12, 13 pilots, but some of those pilots are on the back burner. So you're dealing basically with 8 people, and that could be exhausting by itself. Now, if let's say you don't have to do that, like you're on the 107 route, it would be easier. I know that everybody, regardless, should be documenting their stuff, their flight logs and everything, whether you're 107 or COA or however you operate, you got to have documentation of what you're doing. Because, and how do you know, like you said, maintenance and such as that. The monthly reporting that goes into it, when they generate it, it goes out. that's still somebody that has to do that. Versus somebody that could focus, if you're a smaller department and you don't have that resource of somebody, that means that's going to have to be put onto somebody. Now, the pilot, like the lead pilot or whoever would be in charge overseeing the program, would normally take care of that responsibility and then make sure that every operator has, you know, their stuff current and up to date. With all the easy ways there are to log flights now, that's all done almost electronically. You could push the data from, you know, a DJI account, or there's many different accounts, whether you're using Parrot or such, you could get all that information very easily. But to break it down for a monthly reporting of what airspace you're operating in, where you're operating, the locations, the flight altitudes, the times and stuff like that, that's going to be a taxing on a single individual to deal with if you're a smaller department.
Yeah, I can't imagine. If you're a volunteer department, rural city, or even like a regular city, makes me wonder how many hours per month are you spending just keeping up with these reports? Which brings me to the next point, which I think that most public safety agencies, and particularly a new group who is promoting themselves as a group of responders, I think this is something that they could probably be sued for, based off the lack of information. But I think it's important for guys like you who are willing to save your life, for someone like me who's probably not the nicest person 80% of the time.
You're not a mean person, Paul.
Well, thanks, John. I appreciate that. But I want to, in an effort to try to make your life easier and LEOs and public safety in general, I think it's so important to talk about reporting in COA versus 107, but for a liability purpose. This is what I mean. If I understand the COA properly, most state municipalities and departments do not have to comply, if I understand it right, with many FOIAs. They are federal requests for information, right? But because you're operating now under a federal COA, now all of your flight logs, all of your documents, resources, standard operating procedures, your task list, your proficiency test, most people don't have those, they are now all fully auditable by any American citizen in the entire United States. So if I'm an intelligent pilot and I got involved in a car accident for whatever reason, and let's say that an officer flew a drone, made a bad accident model, and then said that, you know, it the fatality was my fault, I could, as a lawyer, say, well, let's see how credible you are as a drone pilot, and then literally FOIA every single record from the department, like break down their standard operating procedures, compare it to 107, showcase how it's not safety-based at all, which is very easy to do when you just apply risk-based performance language to those things. But then furthermore, I can now get the flight log, and if that pilot has ever flown a training flight, I can pin his ass to the wall. If he's ever flown in controlled airspace without the COA, I can pin his ass to the wall. If he has ever flown outside of the purview of the COA, I can pin his ass to the wall and win my court case by completely defaming the officer and saying that they're not credible because they broke their COA, they flew outside the purview of 107, and how can we expect this officer with this lackluster, incoherent, not systematic approach to flying drones, how can we expect that person to make an accurate 3D model and representation of an accident and say that I'm liable because you measured the skid mark incorrectly, and oh yeah, you didn't geo-reference your map correctly, you didn't use enough GCPs, and I can easily prove that your reprojection error is so bad that the line measurement that you took is not accurate enough to even be utilized in the court of law. Now, I know 90% of the time that's never gonna happen, but there is gonna be one asshole like me who has a lawyer as a father and knows what to do. And because of that, it makes me want to protect police officers. It makes me want to protect firefighters because you are doing things mostly, especially firefighters, for the right intentions. And I think mostly law enforcement is doing that as well, but they have to protect themselves. And when we're in an era of police academies focusing now a majority of their time in liability and focusing how to limit that liability. This is something we have to talk about in regards to COA versus 107, because in my opinion, the liability door is like barn doors opening up with the COA.
Like a hangar door, more like it.
Yeah.
You do the freedom of information requests. You could get any information, like you said, that you want. Whereas 107, you can't. So if you are one of these departments that are utilizing this equipment, such as accident reconstruction or, you know, 3D modeling, where you're looking for survey grade or therefore calling it survey grade without it being survey grade, then that opens up a whole other can of worms, especially with the freedom of information requests. You have access to every flight, the times of those flights, the resources that we use, that includes personnel and type of equipment. And basically you can build a map of somebody's entire program on where they're going, how they're operating and everything else. That is problematic for a lot of, you know, agencies, especially police departments and stuff like that. And I know we don't really like to use the S word, which is surveillance, but let's face it, that's what it could come down to, where now somebody would be able to say, hey, I was, you know, they had eyes on me, and meanwhile they were just operating in that area. So now that, like, how could you prove, you know, that drone wasn't at that location to operate for that particular thing? You know what I mean? So it really does open up a can of worms for a lot of different agencies going with the COA. For fire departments on, like, our end, realistically, we only fly at an emergency. So if you want a freedom of information request from me, sure. You know, just look at the public information of what was burning and when, and you'll pretty much, yeah, we were there. You know what I mean? So for our ends, it's a little different, but for the PD side, where they have, you know, a lot more to deal with, especially on the whole, you know, lawyer aspect, and, you know, if that evidence was obtained correctly or not, it's a huge, huge problem.
Well, and just think about how that could be used for private investigation, right? I talked to a criminal defense lawyer, and he goes, if you just show that anyone in public safety, if they're flying under a COA, flew and there was no emergency, you literally just cut holes in every single process they do and pretty much just killed their ability to showcase credibility and evidence gathering.
Correct. Like, one of the things that we do when we do training flights is we really don't record video unless we're teaching somebody how to utilize a function within that video, operate a thermal camera or use a zoom function, something along those lines. So we try to limit the amount of data we obtain during training, unless it's data that we need to obtain for future training, such as like thermal camera parameters or how to use a zoom function correctly, dual operator, stuff like that, where unfortunately there's no other way around it. Being on the fire side of public safety, they're really not as interested on the firefighter as they are police. We get a whole different kind of approach. We're using drones. Oh, but they're going to save the world with these little aircraft. And, you know, a police department would obtain a tello, and it's, what are they going to do with that? They're watching our every move. You know, they can see us from miles away with this little tello. You know, the public perception is ridiculous between the two. It's apples and oranges.
It's like the analogy that you taught me that one time where the guy stopped you in the middle of the street thinking you were a police officer because you were in an unmarked, and then he realized you were a firefighter and waved and got out of the way.
Yeah, absolutely. The public perception is completely different. So that's another reason to, you know, look at how you're going to be operating and make those adjustments accordingly. Is it better to have the 107 or is it better to have the COA? How do you operate as an entity? Like, we already know the answer that, you know, the 107 is by far a lot easier and it takes up a lot less resources. It just makes sense. The only time that it doesn't is in these big cities where you kind of have to have that COA to to have it, because that's what, you know, the politicians want. They want the ability to look at our flights. They want the ability to let the public know that what we're doing and how we're doing it. And that's in those large cities. But outside of those large cities, then most of the time there is no need. I mean, there's going to be special places where obviously you're going to need a COA, like if you're in between like a whole bunch of military bases or something. Like, there are areas where you're going to need it, but the majority of the time, the 107 is the way to go, and it opens up less ways to get this information that you really don't want, you know, the general public seeing. I mean, if I take a video of a building, a structure fire, okay, sometimes that's just what it is, a video of a fire. But sometimes that video is evidence. You know, let's say it's an arson investigation. Now I have to follow a whole different protocol of what I'm doing, how I take that memory card and deliver it to, you know, the lead fire marshal and so on and so forth. That, you know, we follow a different procedure. And for every application, it's slightly different, you know, depending on what we're asked to do. But, and sometimes the general public doesn't need to know whether that is, you know, evidence. Was that flight for evidence, or was that flight just so we could showcase, you know, how we could utilize this technology? Or maybe I'll say more situational awareness, because we live stream the feed to the chiefs. So he's in the front of the building. We could show him the rear. We could show him the roof. We could, you know, he could get a 360 on this building that's on fire and decide where to best allocate a resource. You know?
Yeah.
And we make the determination on, you know, where the position, what would position would be best from a pilot and safety perspective, but we don't control how that fire or that emergency pans out. Was this an arson? We don't know that until sometimes we're on the ground. And, you know, it might be, hey, by the way, you know, we're going to do an arson investigation on this. Can we have that footage?
Yeah.
You know, now this footage that I was just taking, not to take footage, but for situational awareness, now just became evidence. And yet that's all subject to, like you said, those requests.
Yeah.
So even when you think that you're doing something from on one side, it might as well just turn out to be something completely different. And that's what, you know, like law enforcement would have to watch themselves on and stuff like that, operating under the COA, because sometimes it's not always cut and dry as, oh, just fly this over here and get some situational awareness. That might be evidence as well.
True. And it just goes to show, John, you know, we're all human. We all make mistakes. And I don't think that people should be able to poke the bear with mistakes when it comes to firefighters and law enforcement using drones. Like, I think everyone deserves a little bit of privacy, just like the privacy that you get with your license plate on your car. But kind of circling back and really refocusing, it seems like large city departments who need the legitimacy of the program from the city, they need an included night waiver, they need maybe included transversing people in the COA, the ability to fly in heavily trafficked airspace, they can self-certify pilots, it's constant access to controlled airspace, access to TFRs. So those are kind of the pros for the large cities. It seems like, though, for the rural city department, the smaller city department, and the volunteer departments, because, again, insurance is so different. Training flights are not applicable under a COA. You can only fly in the case of an emergency. But under 107, you can pretty much fly whenever. You can get a nighttime waiver pretty easily. You can use our video to get the nighttime waiver, which has now been used, I think it's like over 1,800 times. But the cons under operating a COA is that the department now takes on all the liability. It won't work for 501c3s. It can't work for a political subdivision. Cannot work for a U.S. territory. The department must own the equipment or have an exclusive lease for 90 days. That won't help volunteer departments. You can only fly in your particular area and nowhere else. And you must share all information with the federal government, which can be FOIA'd. You always have to file a NOTAM, which in Albuquerque, that has only caused us more problems. And you can only operate in emergencies. You cannot train or educate the team under a COA, which I find fascinating because they're saying self-certify your pilots, but you can't train them. Okay. Yes. Okay.
You got to find a big enough hangar to fly.
And also, you might need an aviation attorney just to ensure that everything is done right. But again, if we go back flying under Part 107, you can apply for the SGI just like a COA. The pros of flying under the 107 is that the pilot has the liability rather than the department. They're always under standardized rules that fall and operate within. So you can go from department to department to department. And also the individual has the value then. There's no NOTAM filing, which again, we've found more harm than good with NOTAMs. You can train your entire team under 107. You can hold demos. So if you're trying to show your congressman or congressma'am, your senator, you're trying to show them, this is how we use drones for good. This is how we use drones to save lives. Well, if you're a public agency and you've ever done a demo and you have a COA, guess what? You've been breaking the federal law. So it's really important for people to understand that. But also under Part 107, you can test your equipment legally. The cons, though, if I'm just understanding this all, is that essentially departments may have to file individual controlled airspace authorizations, either under Lance or they would have to get a wide area authorization, which is still plausible. You know, it's not crazy. But anyway, going on. So I know you want to reply. But the cons again, that they must gain access to controlled airspace via Lance or file the wide area authorization. They do have to file additional waivers like the night waiver, transversing people waiver, but there are clear standardized systems now in place. I know it's taken 4 years, but at least there are systems now in place to allow departments to get those particular waivers for nighttime transversing people, etc. And honestly, you know, I think these departments need to do a pricing analysis when it comes to the equipment costs, training costs, supply costs, accessories and support equipment. I mean, if you can't even test the equipment that you're buying under a COA unless you're, I guess, I don't really understand how you do that because you have to have a Part 107 because you can't fly outside of the area with the COA. So how do you test the equipment to fly outside of controlled airspace?
Yeah. Well, like you said, everything that makes its own creates its own problems. 107 is by far, like we've been discussing, a better option for a lot of reasons. Even us, we do our training upstate New York, so our COA isn't applicable up there. So we have to have a 107 and a nighttime waiver to go do our training upstate. That is for our pilot training. We have a safety program up there that we send guys and pilots to. So we need the 107 and the nighttime waiver for our training. However, one of the things that we also do is we also always file NOTAMs, whether we're doing an actual operation or even if we're doing training, and that's just for pilot familiarization, getting used to and accustomed to the system and how it operates and just be keeping the pilots proficient at that. We've got it narrowed down pretty quick where, like, unlike you were saying you were having issues with filing NOTAMs, we have it down where it's pretty smooth sailing. We just give them the information and we get it underway pretty quickly.
It's not the filing that's the problem. It's the, and again, I think NOTAMs in your environment are necessary and effective. In Great. My environment where, again, wide open spaces everywhere, it's like a beacon of like, hey, come check out what we're doing. And so we get all these helicopters. We actually had to call FISDO on a guy who literally buzzed our drone conference because we filed a NOTAM. So, like, So, very different.
Well, for you guys, it's a beacon. For us, it's more of it's what we do. it's a necessity.
Which brings up an important point, which is that not everyone is operating under the same conditions or environment. So, the COA versus 107 is a very personalized decision.
Correct. Another thing that you mentioned in there, you touched on small departments would need an aviation attorney. I think whether they're operating under 107 or they're operating under a COA, I think if you're a smaller department and or any department that's operating with a UAS program, you should have access to an aviation attorney. it's just to answer some of these legal questions that cannot be answered via your legal department. A lot of times they don't understand that, how that operates and how this all ties together, where an aviation attorney is by far would be able to understand that and point the department as a whole in the right direction and answer some of those questions. So that is definitely, I believe, another necessity for any party, whether you're going COA, big time, small time. I think an aviation attorney, always to have one, you know, to double check your stuff is a crucial piece of equipment. And you mentioned that 501Cs cannot file for a COA. You mentioned volunteer departments would have a hard time if, you know, on certain circumstances, some are able to get a COA, most aren't. And that's where it really touches down, because when you look at the majority of how this country operates on its public safety, police departments are normally paid and fire departments are normally volunteer. So once you go outside those major towns or major cities and some, you know, townships and stuff like that, it's a lot of volunteer departments when it comes to fire rescue. They need to operate under a 107 regardless. Some of them might be able to get, you know, the appropriate paperwork for a COA, and most of them can't. So learning the 107 way to go is by far going to open the door for a lot of these small departments. The other thing that you also touched on, I believe, owning equipment for 90 days. For a small department, you're going to buy what you can afford. There are some small departments that are in very wealthy areas that they might decide, hey, I'm going to buy a Matrice N210, you know? And there are some departments where they're, hey, I'm going to buy the Anafi Thermal because that's what we can afford. Either way, no matter which piece of equipment you have, you need to either lease it for 90 days or own it. Now, the leasing of the equipment means if that equipment is damaged, you need a replacement to hold on to it to keep that 90 days open. So if you send out a piece of equipment and you do not have possession of it for more than 90 consecutive days, that could open up a whole nother liability because the equipment technically isn't held for the correct amount of time.
So it sounds to me like there are a lot of pieces of information to consider and many proverbial rabbit holes that you could get trapped into if you make the wrong decision.
Yeah. You can eliminate the majority of those rabbit holes by going 107. The COA, like I said, for the big departments, it's almost a necessity. But even if I wanted to operate under 107 in New York City, I would need the B waiver for JFK. I would need a B waiver for LaGuardia. I would need a B waiver for Newark. And then I don't think I have maybe a nighttime waiver. But realistically, it can be done. It could be. So, but the flexibility of having the 107, having that structure, having that law, having that everything is just to back up the way everybody's on the same page, whether you're flying real estate or you're flying search and rescue missions, you're both following the same protocols on where you can take off from, how you're going to like the times and everything. It's standard across the board. That standardization is really what's going to drive the industry forward rather than trying to have a bunch of different, because basically the more COAs you have, the more different operating procedures you will wind up with. And what's going to work in Miami is not going to work in little town Arkansas. It's not going to work in, you know, a small subsection upstate New York. And now you have areas such as North Carolina, which they have their own system of stuff that's going on there, but how it's not going to work, you know, their system is not going to work in, you know, New Jersey.
Yeah.
So it's,
I know that there, you know, North Carolina's intentions were good to try to create a better standardization. And again, intentions are great. But when the FAA specifically says in their memorandum that, you know, states cannot create registration programs, regulate the skies, and North Carolina just comes out and does it, and then the FAA doesn't do anything to fight it, it really makes you question about credibility in general. But we're not going to go down that rabbit hole.
That's a rabbit hole we can't go down. that's a whole different rabbit hole.
And the guy from the North Carolina Department of Transportation, bless his heart, he's like the nicest guy ever. I've seen him at a couple of conferences. He leaves his card to like, call me, let's talk. I should probably call him sometime. It might be a good conversation.
Like you said, the intentions are good for that. And you know, I commend them on doing something that they feel is productivity, I guess. However, I think it's, you know, not the best way to go, but
agreed.
That's a whole different
agreed. But moving on, John, what you're doing and trying to educate people, I mean, we've been talking for almost 50 minutes now, considering the different options for public safety agencies. And yet when you see these articles coming out from these big groups with a bunch of names on their website, it really makes you question, is this a decision that you can make easily? And for me, if I were in charge of a group of people like you, there's a significant amount of pressure to make the right decision. Because at the end of the day, I have to protect your ass as well. And for me, that makes me want to make sure that I have really deep dived, made the right decisions. I'm not just cut, copying, and pasting other people's standard operating procedures, but rather understanding the information to make the right decision for what line items and specificities to have in those standard operating procedures. And that's not even going into the rabbit hole of currency versus proficiency, my friend.
Oh, absolutely. The easiest way to do it, like you said, is you could always start a program with a 107 and add a COA later if it's needed.
It's probably the faster way to go, too.
Yeah, but like I've mentioned before, that's where if you could start a program with a 107 and see how everything's operating, now bringing in that aviation attorney and say, hey, this is what we got. Do I need to do this? And they're going to answer you, you know, logically, like, hey, well, this might open up transversing over people. Well, if you're in a rural area, how often do you really need that? You don't. In New York City, we have, because of the COA, we have the ability to transverse people. And we don't. We try our hardest not to. And there's no way in the world that you could light a fire in the middle of New York City somewhere and there's not going to be 150 people standing outside watching it at a bare minimum. But even with that, I will take off and I will go over the buildings and around all these people to get where I need to go because it's safer.
I just love that you're setting up that as the routine, the habit, the standard, because when we do these things, they become like literally on autopilot. And that's what I think a lot of people do not understand in the drone industry. You have to set the right foundation right away. Otherwise, you're not going to be successful. And this ideology that you're talking about right here is so perfect because it exemplifies why it's so important to practice safety all the time. Which is why, you know, that whole new program that we're coming out with called PROPS, you know, it's professional, responsible operators that are practicing safety. And that's the key difference.
Absolutely. Safety is number one concern. If you cannot accomplish it safely, don't even fly. If you are, I don't want to say 100% confident, because every time you put up, you know, a piece of equipment in the air, there's always that what if. And there's always that chance that, you know, you could have a failure of something as well. But if you're operating safely, you're mitigating that risk tremendously. The times that we would rather transverse over people rather than, you know, going around the side would be something at night where I don't know what's on top of that roof that I'm going to try to transverse. Sometimes you go up there, there's old TV antennas. Sometimes there's communication lines. Sometimes there's pigeon coops. Stuff like that, and you don't want to wind up running into one of those at night versus, you know, I could easily see where I'm going. That would be, you know, the safer way to go,
yeah.
Keeping control of the aircraft. But when we have the chance to practice, you know, safe with like risk versus reward, we always lie on that risk factor very heavily.
Yeah.
And if that risk is too high, that's it. We don't do what we – well. We do. We have other systems in place that we can easily use. I could take the props off, go around back, take the drone and put it on a table somewhere and do the same thing without taking that risk that I could do with it in the air and guess what? It makes a great ground camera because it lasts almost forever when it's not running the props.
Yeah. We've been talking a lot about that actually with one of our good friends, Stephen Sharp. He talks about perching, just flying in, just land right on like a, you know, on the fence. If it's like a cinder block fence or, you know, land on something nearby, you can fully control the camera once you land. Like you said, it can be there pretty much indefinitely as long as you leave enough power to take off and return home. But it's a powerful tool.
Yeah, definitely something that we're kind of experimenting with now, which would be the perching. However, like I said, New York City and different buildings are different. So we don't want to land on a building and then wind up with magnetic interference taking off.
Good point.
Or something along those lines. So for us, that idea is, even though it's in the works, we're still trying to mitigate yet again the risk of landing this somewhere where it's probably not the best spot to take off from. So it's all this risk versus reward, basically. But nothing's going to stop me from ringing the doorbell and going up to the 6 stories and sitting on the roof with the thing.
Yeah.
You know, rather than, you know, flying it over there, I could easily walk and accomplish the same goal. So it's, you have a test to do and there's 2 ways to do it. We go to the way that's going to be safer rather than what would be, you know, quicker.
For sure. John, I just want to say, like, really thank you as a 15-year vet of the FDNY. And I just say veteran, meaning you have 15 years of experience. You're still there. Greatly appreciate your expertise, my friend. I think this information hopefully will really help a lot of people, and they really have you to thank. So thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Anytime you have, any questions or anything, just always hit me up. I'm always available.
Don't worry, John. We always love hearing your opinion, too, about the best drones for public safety, which makes me wonder if you've gotten your hands on that Evo 2 thermal yet to see if you like it more than the Mavic 2 Enterprise Dual, because now, you know, DJI was doing their drone training and they had, I think it was like 3 or 4 attitude mode exercises, yet they were training on the Enterprises, which didn't have attitude mode. Well, luckily, praise the Lord, they now have attitude mode on them because of that training. And you know what? Everyone benefited from that. So I love it.
As far as the new Autel, I have seen it. I seen it when it was pre-release. The software on it wasn't the original software that they're probably using now. So what I'm limited to talk about on it is from what I've seen. And it's a very promising piece of equipment. The camera is absolutely amazing. To put the 640 thermal on there is huge for public safety. It allows you that capability where you don't need to be as close to the subject to get those accurate readings. As we all know with the Mavic Dual, it's sometimes you got to be closer to get those accurate temperature readings. And I'm not talking like a structure fire where the temperature difference is tremendous. One, it's either the building 700 degrees or it's 60. We're talking like those fine tuned details. Like if you were looking for, let's say, a person in the water along those lines, to get a hit on the Mavic Dual, you would need to be 60 feet roughly because it's a 120 sensor. So 120, 4 pixels per sensor means roughly 60 feet to get a temperature hit on somebody's, you know, the top of their head in the water. That 640 is going to open that up a tremendous difference. You'll be able to cover more water from higher up because the higher you are, you'll see more and have the same kind of results. So it is going to be a nice piece of equipment. I also love the fact that they limit nothing on where you can fly, take off, and launch from. For us in public safety, I really haven't had any problems with the DJI unlock that stopped us from operating, but we had to set that all up before we started using the equipment, which was time consuming. It took almost a week between you got every pilot, every piece of equipment, and outburdened every pilot's software to their own account. It took a while. I would say probably in more cases, 2 weeks. And then if we bought a new piece of equipment or one came out and one came back, now that has to be changed over as well for that new piece of equipment. So the fact that you're able to take off anywhere pretty much is like a huge game changer for us. The Autel was a great piece of equipment. It was very stable, but when I tested this equipment, I was in a very rural setting. There was no Wi-Fi interference. There was no magnetic interference. I was literally in the middle of nowhere in Mississippi somewhere. And it was a powerful tool then. I'd seen a lot of potential with that. And I'm hoping to see, to actually get my hands on one to test out in the big city, probably within the near future.
Us too. It'll be interesting to see how it actually performs. Haya was on the news show yesterday stating that there was an issue with distance. So it should be interesting. But John, again, just want to say thank you so much for having you on the show, my friend. I think we just set the record for the longest podcast, by the way. So,
well, you give us a hard topic such as 107 part versus COA. I mean, you can't expect it to be 10 minutes.
So true.
And the funny thing is, we could keep going and make this like a 2-hour session because there's just so much to cover. And you understand it because you're going through it. But really, there's topics in there that we didn't even discuss.
True.
You know?
True.
So.
No, I'm aware. That's why they're going to have to check out our new public safety course. But that brings us to the end of the show, my friend. And I am really excited to have you on, and I really do appreciate it. And I think so many public safety officers are going to be grateful for having you here today. So once again, from us all, thank you.
No, thank you, Paul. Stay safe, everybody.
We will do. Thank you, John. And for everyone watching out there, thank you for listening. Please don't be afraid to share this with someone who you might find could benefit from it. I mean, I'm sure you love the feeling of helping other people. And if you want to help someone who's in public safety, they may need to hear this information. So don't be afraid to share it. Leave us a review. And if you're watching on YouTube, don't be afraid to subscribe. That's going to do it for us today. My name is Paul. Thank you to our guest, Mr. John Wakey from the FDNY. That's going to do it for us today here at Ask Drone U.
We believe that videos, images, words, and sounds have the absolute power to inform, inspire, and entertain. We reject indecision, confusion, and vanity, for they work against the community. We are united under the virtues of safety and knowledge. We are a training community of learners and teachers who encourage and energize each other to achieve greatness. We are pilots, videographers, photographers, freelancers, business owners, enthusiasts, experts, and apprentices. We are creators. We are the Drone U.